I'm Dan Pierce, and this is Pressure Cooker.
I said I will never wear the hijab or give up my mini skirts. Never.
It's the outrageous story of two misfits living on the fringes and how they became the central players in a sprawling terror investigation.
We just hung out and played video games and smoked weed and did what we do, you know.
Pressure Cooker is available on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. According to a number of Canadian studies, as few as 1 in 300 sexual assaults end in conviction in this country. The vast majority of survivors never report their assaults to authorities. Researchers have found that they believe the process will be ineffective and re-traumatizing. The CBC's John Chipman has the story of a survivor who fought to try a different type of process, one more focused on healing. A warning, this story includes descriptions of sexual assault and its aftermath, including suicidal thoughts. Here is John's documentary, Marley's Circle.
Back in the fall of 2016, Marley Liss was a university student in Toronto. And after a summer away, she was excited to reconnect with friends. A week into classes, she planned a night of fun with two girlfriends. They'd have some drinks at a bar, then crash at her friend's place downtown. But as the night wore on, one friend went home early, and then Marley started to lose steam.
I got to this point of like, okay, I'm drunk, I'm tired, ready to go home. So I started looking around, trying to find the one friend who was still there, and I just couldn't find her. And that's kind of when this man that I had never met before approached me and was super generous at first, was like, oh, are you looking for someone? Like, what do they look like? I can help you look.
He looked to be about Marley's age or a little older, in his mid-20s. Neither of them could find her friend.
And then I'm like, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to get a cab and go to my friend's place. I know one of them is there. He says, oh, I'll help you get a cab.
And in a strange coincidence, they soon discovered that he lived in the same building as Marley's friend. They shared a cab back, but when they arrived, Marley realized that she didn't know the unit number for her friend's apartment. She tried calling and texting, but got no reply.
And at this point, I was like, I'm so exhausted. I feel like I just need to like lie down, drink water.
And that's when her cabmate asked if she wanted to wait in his unit while she continued trying to reach her friend.
There's always that like little ounce of self-blame that's like, well, why would you do that? That's stupid, you know, even though I don't believe that on a logical level.
They went up to his apartment. He got her a glass of water. She laid down on his couch and he left her to rest. Marley started to drift off.
And then he came back in a minute later and just totally 180'd. He like pulled my pants down really fast and then started touching me. And I, you know, thought back to everything we learn as like women in the world. I was like, okay, what am I supposed to say right now? And I remember saying like, no, I don't want this.
But her assailant didn't stop.
And I had this scary moment where I realized that my voice didn't have any power. And so at that point, I kind of just froze. And I just like lay there and he like covered my mouth at one point and just proceeded to assault me for 4 or 5 hours.
Marley remembers the pain of the assault and bewilderment.
Every so often he would stop and say, I'm so sorry, this is so messed up. And then he would continue, which was very confusing.
Hours passed in a haze of shock and abuse until Marley noticed early morning light coloring the window. Her assailant was in the bathroom, so she grabbed her clothes and ran out. Marley went home to her apartment.
I remember just standing outside my roommate's door for what felt like forever, thinking that I could knock now and tell her what happened, or I might not ever tell anyone at all. I feel very grateful that she believed me, and we didn't really know what to do. We ended up Googling, what do you do when you're raped? We like had no idea. And it was like, go to the hospital and get a rape kit. We went to one hospital.
But it was understaffed that day, so they told Marley to come back later.
They were like, you can wait 24 hours, you're not allowed to shower, you're not allowed to change, and then we can do it. And that is such an awful thing, the idea of not showering, and like I had his like semen on me and my clothes, like, you know what I mean? It was so like degrading. And so we ended up going to a different hospital.
After Marley got the rape kit completed at another facility, the nurse called police. Marley said she found the detectives cold and detached. She'd already written an account of what happened. She wasn't ready to say it out loud. The two detectives took her written statement, then told Marley she'd also have to describe the assault to them in painfully specific detail.
A lot of questions that nobody would know the answer to, even if it was consensual, whatever. Like, if his hand was here facing to like a 2 o'clock position, where was his other hand? Like, it was so precise.
Marley's assailant was arrested and charged with sexual assault. He pleaded not guilty. For Marley, the next step would be his preliminary hearing, which would determine if there was sufficient evidence to proceed to trial. But that wouldn't happen for a while. 2 years, in fact. In the meantime, Marley tried to restart her life at university.
I tried to go back to school, and like my ears started ringing, and I had this big lump in my throat. And I think the next few months were this ongoing experience of realizing like, wow, trauma does impact you to this degree. Like, I was like suicidal for a lot of that. I didn't know if I wanted to even like live in this world where we treat each other like that.
To get ready for her testimony, Marley took an hour-long prep course.
And I was incredibly hurt by how much that process recreated the powerlessness. I was told that if I refuse to answer a question or am unable to answer a question on the stand, I could be charged as non-cooperative. I was told that I shouldn't speak to the friend roommate that had been through the whole process with me because we could corroborate on a story and she was going to be a witness. I was told to wear a gray turtleneck, to not wear any makeup, to tie my hair back, to really present as this like credible victim. I was told to be emotional, but not too emotional, to also not be stoic, like all of this ridiculous prep.
About a week before the preliminary hearing, Marley met Kara Sweeney, the Crown attorney who would be prosecuting her assailant.
I have spent my practice as a Crown attorney being an advocate for survivors of sexual violence, treating survivors, witnesses, victims, whatever you call them, everyone, like they matter.
There's a reason Kara empathizes so deeply with sexual assault survivors. She is one herself.
When I was in law school, I was sexually assaulted by a friend of another law student. And I did everything you're not supposed to do. Like, I didn't tell anyone, and I kept in contact with him a little bit. And I knew I would never, ever go to the police. And I want to be the person that I needed in the system.
Kara was at a turning point in her career when the case against Marley's assailant came across her desk. She was highly seasoned, 17 years as a Crown at that point, with a specialty in sexual assault cases against adults and children. But she was growing more and more frustrated. A couple of years earlier, Kara had lost the sexual assault case she thought was a slam dunk. It was devastating.
It just was like, for me, a point in which I realized that the system doesn't always work, because I thought, if I can't win that one, like, what can I win?
At that first meeting, Kara said preliminary hearings are often re-traumatizing. She told Marley that she hoped it might not be for her, but it was.
I mean, the preliminary trial was horrible. It was so dehumanizing, deeply like misogynistic. My assailant's just like sitting in the crowd, staring at the floor the whole time while I feel like I'm on trial. Like, his defense lawyer would just ask these like horrible questions. One of the questions, how many thrusts per minute? And I just like stared at him. I was just like, are you serious? Like, hello, human being, are you there? So it was horrible.
In 2019, the federal government did away with preliminary hearings in all but the most serious cases of sexual assault and those in which the victims are children. But this preliminary hearing was in 2018, and it left Marley reeling.
I felt like I was a million steps back in my healing and was back to this like deeply depressive, concerning place. And I remember for a whole week, I was like bawling. I would like try to go to classes or the grocery store and I would like burst into tears.
Because the prelim was just the beginning, she still needed to testify at trial. She wasn't sure she could do it.
Like I had this hole in my chest. Like, it's just like, what is this all for? And I ended up talking to another friend about it. And she asked me, if it was your world and anything was possible, like, what would you want to happen? And I said, I would want us to handle this like human beings who sit down and have a conversation and cry and get angry. And I would want an apology. I would want him to do the deep transformation work that means that he would not do this again. And she just looked at me and said, so make it happen. And that was the very first time that I considered acting on what I wanted.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
So Marley started doing research and talking to people until someone mentioned a process she'd never heard of before, restorative justice. Restorative justice has deep roots in Indigenous communities. Sometimes it functions as an offshoot of the criminal justice system, and others, it's separate. It can happen before, during, after, or in place of the traditional criminal process. Advocates describe restorative justice as a way of addressing conflict and crime that encourages dialogue between the person who was harmed and the person who caused the harm, along with people from their communities.
It was this incredible moment where I was like, wow, this process is exactly what I need.
The challenge for Marley would be accessing it. Restorative justice is commonly used to resolve conflicts between neighbors or within families. It's also used for minor offenses, property crimes, or those involving first-time or young offenders. It's rarely used for more serious crimes like sexual assaults. And Marley wanted restorative justice in place of a trial, meaning no more charges against the defendant, no chance of conviction or incarceration. Critics of restorative justice say sexual assault is too serious a crime. Perpetrators need to go to prison. What's to stop an offender from faking an apology to avoid a potential conviction? Marley's mind was made up. She was not going to testify at trial, even if it meant the case collapsed. It was either restorative justice or nothing at all. However, she'd have to convince the Crown, who had the final say. It was a new approach for Kara, but she was intrigued. She agreed to pause the prosecution. The defendant and Marley would meet face-to-face in a restorative circle to talk through the harm he had caused.
I will say that that one moment was so deeply healing and so deeply meaningful because it was the first time in 3 years dating back to the experience of the rape itself that I was like, oh, my voice does have power. That alone was so huge.
There were ground rules for the circle. First off, nothing the assailant said, nothing he admitted to doing, could be used as evidence against him at any subsequent trial. Similarly, everyone participating agreed to protect his anonymity. Through his lawyer, the assailant declined my interview request.
My biggest fear was that he would just show up to get a check mark. He'd kind of be like, lean back, arms crossed, sort of say what he needs to say, right? I wanted this like real, authentic healing experience.
Kara decided she would leave it up to Marley to choose if her assailant had done enough in the circle.
And I told that to the defense lawyer. I said, I will defer to her. So if Marley is happy, I'm happy. If she's not happy, then we're going to trial.
The first step before they met was for Marley's assailant to do therapy on his own.
And it was the first time that I felt like hope, lightness, like I can actually enjoy my life right now while he's in therapy. And we would hear about some of the themes that were being looked at, unpacking things like misogyny and toxic masculinity and the role of alcohol and communication around consent. So to know that my rapist was doing that work was like incredibly meaningful and empowering.
Seven months passed as he continued his sessions, and then it was time. The circle would be arranged and facilitated by the Neighborhood Group, a Toronto NGO that specializes in conflict resolution and restorative justice. Two mediators would oversee the participants. That's Marley, her mother and sister, her lawyer, Kara, Marley's assailant, and a friend of his. The group gathers at TNG's offices in downtown Toronto. Seven chairs, one for each participant, sit in a circle in the middle of the room. A tree of driftwood sprouts from a round, rose-covered canvas on the floor. Pieces of colorful paper with handwritten words, honesty, compassion, courage, lie among stones and bowls of pine cones and tree bark. The idea behind the centerpiece is to give people something to focus on when the conversation turns difficult. A large conch shell will be passed among the participants to signify who is the floor to speak.
They really only asked us one question, which was, what brought you here today? And the first time I spoke, it really was just get everything out of my body that I'd been holding on to for 3 years. The anger, the frustration, the confusion, the grief, the sadness, including like the empowerment, joy I'd experienced, like letting that be in the room too, like all of it.
Marley's assailant sits opposite her, listening intently as she speaks.
Like to see that he was making eye contact the whole time and like tears in his eyes, like hand on heart at moments. A lot of the time when I'd talk about like how low I was, like considering taking my life, he'd look at my mom and then look back at me.
And then it's her assailant's turn to speak.
What was so compelling was how devastating it was for him. His story ended up to me being the eye-opening moment.
He shared that he actually did deny that this happened at first to himself. And it wasn't until a friend in his life experienced sexual violence and told him about it, and he expressed some kind of like empathy to them, that he said in that moment, it felt like his memories unlocked. And he was like, remembered every detail of that night and was like overcome with shame and guilt and remorse, to the point that like in the time following that, he got to a place of considering taking his life. And to me, that was such a powerful parallel, to realize that both of us from this were both considering taking our lives around the same time. And instead, we're sitting here in this circle. And he did look at me and take full accountability, looking me in the eyes. He said, I'm sorry, I sexually assaulted you. There's nothing I can do to take it back, but I hope that being here today can help. And for some people, those might sound like just words. They might say like, that's not enough or something. I like burst into tears. Like I felt like a knot untied in my stomach. It felt like the deepest relief. Like I didn't even realize I needed that much. I really didn't. I just was like, wow, like this is seemingly such a simple thing, but like it is hits on such a deep level of like, yes, this person did do this and they're fully admitting that they did it and they're deeply remorseful. Like it was so huge.
It was one of the most incredible experiences of my legal career, if not my life.
The conversation doesn't stop with his admission. The conch shell makes another two full trips around the circle as the group delves deeper into the consequences and how to move forward. In all, they talk and listen for 8 hours.
I said to Marley as we were leaving, I was like, so? And she's like, oh my God, that was my rape trial. And I was like, oh my God, that was your rape trial. And like, she was so happy.
I was like, holy crap, like we did that. Like I was really proud of myself.
I always thought this is what survivors need. But I realize now it's what offenders need. It's what the accused need because they don't learn anything from a trial. I think some people think this is a get out of jail free card. No. Get out of jail free card is running a trial and being acquitted. But going to counseling and then having the courage to sit in front of the person who you sexually assaulted and hear her say all the things that you did to her, like that requires incredible strength and courage.
I think we're so taught that transformation is never an option. It's impossible. Like no one's ever going to change. Maybe sometimes that's the case, but I think it's almost always not true. This is healing to a degree that I've never been taught was possible.
You've been listening to Marley's Circle. It's a documentary by John Chipman. John's with me in studio now to talk about what has happened since the case against her assailant ended. John, good morning.
Hey, Matt.
That's really powerful. Is it still possible, given what we've just heard, to resolve sex assault cases in Ontario through a restorative circle?
It's not, actually. Marley may have been happy with how the case was resolved, but Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General was not. It oversees criminal prosecutions in the province, and shortly after Marley's circle, it took restorative justice off the table as a way to resolve sexual assault cases involving adult defendants. Now, it does remain an option in cases where the alleged perpetrator is a young person or mentally ill.
I mean, given what we just heard, what's the reasoning behind that?
A spokesperson for the ministry sent me a statement that read in part, and I'm quoting here, "Sexual offenses pose a serious threat to individual and public safety, and they are prosecuted vigorously," end quote. Now, that's similar to what I heard from other critics as well. I spoke with a former sex crimes investigator with the Vancouver Police Department, and she argued that prosecuting sex assaults as aggressively as possible is in the best interest of public safety, even if conviction rates are painfully low. But interest from survivors, that also continues. Marley's lawyer, his name is Jeff Carolyn, he says that he's received calls from about 8 more survivors in the 5 years since Marley's circle. I spoke with one of them, and she says she was devastated that restorative justice was not an option in her assailant's case. Like Marley, she decided that she wasn't comfortable testifying at his trial, and the case against him collapsed.
That's the situation in Ontario. What do we know about what's happening in the rest of the country?
So I contacted ministries of the Attorney General or Justice in all of the provinces and territories. Everybody got back to me. 7 say they do permit restorative justice resolutions in sexual assault cases involving adult defendants. That's Newfoundland and Labrador, PEI, New Brunswick, Manitoba, Alberta, BC, and Yukon. Mm. The rest do not. But even in those provinces and territories that do, it does seem kind of more theoretical. Yukon was the only one that confirmed that it had, in fact, allowed diversions, 7 since 2021, for 6 youth and 1 adult. The rest would not or could not confirm if similar diversions or resolutions had ever been requested or granted in their provinces.
This is really interesting, John. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt.
John Chipman is a producer with CBC's Audio Documentary Unit.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.